And it is time now to check in with our staff physicist. It's been a long journey for Perseverance. It's NASA's latest Mars rover. It landed safely on the red planet yesterday, 3:55 p.m. It's Eastern time. It was 4 our time. Is that right, Aaron?
Well, it's approximately correct.
Okay.
The time that NASA was giving out, of course, is the time at which their broadcast, if all went well, was going to inform us that the rover had landed. It had actually landed about, whatever it is, 11 or 12 minutes before that. One of those things, depending on where Earth and Mars are exactly in each orbit, you're somewhere between 10, 12 minutes away from the planet via the speed of light.
How long does it?
I was watching this too with sort of bated breath and hoping and texting with some other people who were watching at different places. And I kept having to remind myself that, you know, don't get all excited. This thing has already happened. It's either landed or made a new crater.
And there was a tweet when it happened. Perseverance will get you anywhere.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, Aaron,
I'm always kind of, I guess, old man skeptical or something about trying to cutify science too much. And NASA is particularly obnoxious at it from time to time. And some of this programming leading up to it was, you know, NASA's fumbling to sort of cutify what was going on. But I was hugely impressed by I think he was 12 and I think she was 13, I'm not quite sure, the two kids who, through their essays that they had contributed, had won the right to name both Perseverance and the little drone Ingenuity. I was terribly impressed by their responses to the, oh, let's be cute questions posed by the people in the programming. The kids were better. Good for them.
So, Aaron, yesterday on National Public Radio, I don't remember the stats, but throw some stats at us. They interviewed a guy who was obviously there in the control center saying, imagine that. It's a metal, it's an object that's traveling 1,700 miles per hour or something like that, going da-da-da-da. Tell us a little bit about that. What you know.
Well, let's call it intercept speed between the spacecraft carrying Perseverance and Mars was, depending on when you want to measure that, but somewhere between 12,000 and 16,000, something like that, miles per hour. It's fairly high velocity on the intercept speed. The atmosphere of Mars is so darn thin. It's roughly the same as ours is an altitude of 100,000 feet, something like that. And so it's space suit environment for a human. And so a spacecraft with its heat shield and so on coming into that atmosphere doesn't encounter as much of a stopping force as a spacecraft, say, returning from the moon or something, entering the Earth's atmosphere. It's a real diluted atmosphere. As a consequence, one of the things they do is they really plunge quickly into the atmosphere. A steep, relatively steep angle, I don't know, 15, 20 degrees, something like that. You would never do that with a spacecraft returning from, say, the moon to the Earth. It would just break it up and or incinerate it. So I was watching on NASA's screen while this was going on. I guess the print was so darn small. Us old people need bigger print, damn them. But at any rate, it looked to me like that thing was pulling upwards of 10 and 12 G's deceleration when it got down into a bit thicker atmosphere, lower in Mars's atmosphere. You'd have had everybody aboard that spacecraft blanked out by that time. Well, maybe not, but they'd know it.
So, Aaron, you talked about this heat shield, and I'm assuming they're trying to make things lighter. What is the heat shield made of, and what does it look like? Is it thick?
I don't know. These days, once upon a time, they were a metal-based honeycomb covered with some kind of goo. Again, I don't know exactly what was dealt, but it's throwaway material. What's happening there is a transformation of energy, really, from the kinetic energy that the spacecraft has coming in. The atmosphere breaks it, slows it down, and that energy has to go somewhere. And what it goes into is the heat. And the heat shield does just that. It shields everything in back of it, the actual spacecraft and so on, from entering the Earth's atmosphere. Generates temperatures 4,500 degrees. Everything glows, you know, really flames and glows. I'm not sure if that, being that Mars' atmosphere is considerably thinner, I'm not sure it's that high. But you need to strip off that energy that was kinetic and turn it into something else. And at least initially, that's done by the heat shield. When the spacecraft has dropped low enough in speed, then they pop this big supersonic, they call it parachute. That's a story in itself. The development of being able to create parachutes that open and stay open and don't oscillate violently at supersonic speeds, that's been a story in development, both for Earth orbital stuff and something like this for a few decades now. And finally, of course, after the parachute bleeds off some more speed, that it converts that kinetic energy into random chaotic energy of the parachute moving through this thicker atmosphere, then the parachute leaves, the heat shield drops away, and the thing starts using powered descent to kill off the rest of the speed. It's an impressive process. When they first did this for Curiosity, of this sky crane arrangement, I thought, it's just crazy. It'll never work. There's too much stuff. Well, this is the second time they've pulled it off. Apparently, they've kind of got it down pat.
We're talking with our staff physicist, Aaron Wanger. We're talking about Perseverance, NASA's latest Mars rover. So what does this mean? Why were you excited by this?
Well, all the good stuff is yet to come. I mean, I'm still sort of sitting here holding breath that over the next 4 or 5 days that we find out all of the systems on board this rover are indeed working. The last time that we put a rover down on the surface of Mars, not a rover, a spacecraft on the surface of Mars that had a chance of detecting microbe, at least life, was in 1976, I believe. We did two of them. That still amazes me. But in 1976, that means that they were using mid-1960s technology, because it takes about that long to develop a spacecraft. We landed Viking 1 and Viking 2 on the surface of Mars. They weren't rovers. Wherever they landed is where they stayed. But they did have, by today's standards, primitive cameras, TV cameras on board, and were able to do, for the time, even today, fairly sophisticated chemistry remotely that had a chance, at least, of detecting microbe life in the soils of Mars. They couldn't drill, they could scoop up, but one of the two had, it's still argued about today, had a real positive response for there being something in the soil of Mars that, when you gave it nutrients, released some gases, either methane or carbon dioxide or whatever, to the atmosphere of the spacecraft. It's called a labeled release experiment. And it was a pretty positive indicator of something life-related going on in the soil by that lander. Over the years, the overwhelming consensus is that what it was detecting was inorganic, non-life chemistry. That's the overwhelming consensus. But at the time, man, it was exciting. But this is the first rover who has a chance of detecting microbe type life, or at least the remnants of it, in the soils of Mars. Much, much more sophisticated chemistry lab on board it. Much, of course, greater ability both to move and go to interesting looking places, and also being able to drill to take samples. I'm less enthused over the prospect of it being able to take core samples, but then it spits out eventually caches someplace there on the surface in the hope. It's not expectation, the hope that sometime within the ensuing decade that we get another spacecraft in orbit and a spacecraft on the surface that can pick these things up, get them back up to Mars orbit, and then escape Mars, make a return trip to Earth. I'm less certain about that. Not because of the science, mostly because I'm skeptical to look ahead 8 or 10 years on this planet anymore. No, I mean it.
Yeah, I know you do. Well, Aaron, that's great stuff. Great stuff. Now I want to get back to a couple things I've been dying to ask you. Major League Baseball is now reducing the baseball so it flies 5 to 10 feet shorter. How do they do it?
Probably raise the seams a little bit, and most likely, of course, to mess around with the core and windings inside the baseball. Anyone who's played the game much has been able to notice the difference between an old skinned-up baseball that you've batted and thrown around for half a summer and a brand-new one out of the box. Besides the fact that the brand new one smells good, it has never rolled in pig poop in the pasture yet. Besides the fact that it smells good and is nice and beautiful, it has a different feel in your hand. And it feels different when you throw it. I always kind of liked it in a way, because as it gets skinned up a little bit, it means you can really break off a curve. Some of the old guys, I guess, Hoyt Wilhelm, a knuckleballer, was one who I guess was known for being able to scruff a baseball with like a thumbnail and get a little bit more surface there that made the knuckler dance even more. Okay. But I imagine a lot of it is done just by, as I understand, I think it's one company, I forget, and it's a South American or Central American country. Oh. Who makes the baseballs for the baseball leagues?
You know, you find it's interesting to know that scuffing a baseball makes it jump all over the place. Yet it was pitchers, I believe, whom a long time ago would ask the umpire to change balls because it got scuffed. So I'm assuming that the scuff has to be in the correct place. Because my goodness, they hit one ball and they take it out of play.
Not all pitchers, after all, are trying to break off a sharp breaking curve or something. Plus a pitcher, a real pitcher, is concerned about throwing strikes, not just balls. And I'm afraid I have to admit, I'd love to have you standing at the plate and I'd be throwing curve balls at you. You'd be dancing like a jig, man.
Judas Priest.
I didn't have great control over where it was going.
Effective, though. Effective.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Early win. Old Cleveland Indian pitcher was notorious. I mean, he had excellent control. A guy could have thrown a baseball through an eye of a needle. But, man, if he caught you leaning just a little bit to protect the outside part of the plate, he'd throw at your head. It was a kind of precision. He still knew what he was doing.
Oh, sure he did, yeah. So, Heidi, can I ask him one more question? It's one, Aaron, that it's been grinding me since my youth. And I may sound stupid, but I don't care. I was raised with the old verse that said, step on a crack, break your mama's back. Now, I have been doing some independent research, mainly in the summertime, walking from KAXE to, say, the library under brand new conditions of a sidewalk. And they lay those, and they lay that sidewalk in perfectly. You know, the forms are the same distance. They bump, move. Each one is the same distance. Yet, when I start my foot in one direction as not to break my mom's back, I stride. I probably walk through 10 sections of concrete, and it's perfect. Then all of a sudden, my stride forces me to step on the crack. What the hell is going on?
I don't know, John.
You don't?
I'm afraid I can't speak to ridiculous superstition.
Thank you, Aaron.
This is not superstition. This is real. I'll take you out there and we'll do it together. No. I start at different starting points and it's the same thing.
Well, let's break it
time.
Down now, John. Where are you? Are you drinking before this?
Don't even talk to him about it, Heidi. Judas Priest. I'm sitting here in a beautiful Minnesota winter morning, blue sky, birds visiting my feeder. We have a pileated woodpecker that comes in each morning. He comes in early before all the chickadees and nuthatches and stuff show up. I think he considers himself superior. He comes in and eats suet. But beautiful morning. My horses are standing with their heads out the barn door waiting for me to show up. I've got to take food down to the two pigs. I've got to check on the sheep and give them some feed. We have a couple of ewes that look like they're going to burst if you prick them with a pin. I'm sure they're waiting for a cold, ugly night to deliver these damn lambs.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not interested in sidewalk cracks.
I'm a crackpot. Oh, jeez. Okay, well, I'm still getting
now, I have a question for you. You guys, you know, you sort of sitting by the side, listen to news all the time. Is there any good news ever going to happen about when we can re-enter Canada? It's driving me nuts. It's been now a year.
Yeah,
more. A year and a third since I was last able to go up to our place in Canada. And I can't hardly stand it.
Well, take some more time with your sheep and stuff. Just relax, Judas Priest. Settle down.
Can't I take it, man. Yeah. A friend of mine up there who lives not far from where what is our cabin now, back in, sent me three pictures from his one trail cam of a set of three fairly young, it appears to me, wolves who were traipsing along on the trail and came up and investigated the trail cam. And it is so good. The one, you can recognize them, the different face markings and so on. And the one makes two attempts or walks up to the trail cam pretty close. And a couple of others strung out in back of him. And he must have, I don't know if the trail can, when it takes a picture, maybe there's a small shutter noise. Anyhow, something scared that wolf that was the closest. And on the it takes a picture about every half second under those conditions. And the wolf that was in the back absolutely just about turned himself inside out, it appears, jumping and spinning to get out of there. I miss it.
Now, Aaron, yeah. I think there's a way to get around it if you get a job there and you have to go there for work. So if you could, you know, get someone to hire you for something, you might be able to,
go. I used to work there. I worked for Confederation College. I imagine I still could. They had a branch in Fort Francis. They're out of Thunder Bay. I imagine I still get, and I've tried to talk them out of it and can't do it. I still get the Canadian equivalent of Social Security. They call it social insurance for my time working for Confederation College. And the amount of money is so small, I'm sure it costs them more in bookkeeping fees and postage. But you can't get out of the loop.
Well, in a
once
sense,
they got
then,
you, they got you.
Well, in a sense, you're an employee then. You got to be thinking. Heidi, yeah. That's tremendous.
Well,
you'll get in.
I don't know. If I could just show up and say I'm late for class.
Maybe just get bring the small check
bring your receipt
and perhaps that might get you through. I'm just saying I have heard people who need to travel through Canada to get to Alaska that have done that by saying they need to get to their job on either side, and there's only one place that they actually have a job. So,
and Aaron, you could try out for the Minnesota Wild. I mean, they're allowed to go, so they can go into Canada.
Oh, that's
Canada.
A good call too, John. Good, yeah. There you go, Aaron. Hmm. We solved your life for you. Now I think you got to go to your horses, but we hope you'll be back sooner rather than later.
Well, you guys take care. It's fun talking with you.
You
good
too.
Talking with you.